Did you get the manuscript? He said, and he just kind of brushed, oh, yeah, I got it, and I'll read it when I get around to it. You know, just kind of blew it off. I knew their attitude had changed for some reason, and no apparent reason, that their attitude toward the book had changed. So I couldn't get a hold of me. I couldn't get a hold of Alice. And finally, I called her secretary and said, I'm coming up there on March the 18th. Make an appointment. Put it in her appointment book. I'm going to fly up at my own expense to talk to her. Well, 2 days before that, Alice sends me a fax saying, we're going to have to postpone our meeting until next week. I'm real busy. Hope that's okay. So I called up her secretary immediately, and that's when she put Alice on the phone. And I said, hey, this book needs to go for the presidential election. We got to get moved. And she said, there's no way. We don't have time. I'm not going to crash this book, which means put it on a crash program to publish it early. I argued with her. You know, it's got all this stuff about George Bush that the American public needs to know. And her reply was, quote, George Bush is going to win anyway, close quote.
When did this happen?
Is in March of this year. George Bush is going to win anyway. And then another thing she said when I was arguing about it, she said, quote, nobody reads anything in September and October, close quote. Now, I don't know what's going on in her mind, you know, what her motives were, whether she really believed this. I'm telling you, that's what she said to me to try to give a reason why they weren't going to publish this book before the election. And that's when I made the decision, I'm getting out, I'm finding another publisher. There were some other problems. Simon Schuster eventually ended up breaching the contract, and so that gave me an out, and I terminated the contract and went to Schapolsky. And Schapolsky has just been wonderful in getting this book out for the election.
And they're publishing it in their SPIs.
SPI is an affiliate of Schapolsky Publishers, right. Yes.
And that's the book is coming out on SPI, and it's being distributed by Hearst.
That's correct.
And that's the book we're talking about right now is George Bush, the Mafia, and the CIA. No? What are we talking about here?
Close.
George Bush, the CIA, and the Mafia. And we're speaking with Pete Bruton, and we're talking about the struggle to get the book out. And I guess I want to ask you, did you want to add something to that? Is there something?
The titles.
Okay, I want to ask you this, Pete. This is the final question. You talked about roadblocks in terms of the Houston Post. You talked about roadblocks in terms of publishing it. And by the way, on the cover of the book, it's listed this is the book that Simon & Schuster wouldn't publish. So look for that little gold star. What other risks were there? You were publishing material about very dangerous people, people who are known not to let human life stand in the way of their own economic progress. Were there any threats to your life? Were there any times when you felt that your life was in danger? Was this a risk? I mean, going up there on Long Island and approaching, talking to sort of mob-related people who are standing there looking at you very angrily, barefooted?
Well, the mob is supposed to have an unwritten code that they don't mess with policemen, judges, and journalists. They've stepped over the line on that a number of occasions. But I think I kind of snuck up on them. And they weren't really expecting anything. And by the time that I'd done it, it was too late for them to do anything to stop it. You know, and doing anything to me would just give them more negative publicity. I mean, bring more spotlight on them. And that's the whole reason they're supposed to leave journalists alone. I mean, journalists can just give them bad publicity. We can't convene a grand jury and indict them and then serve as judge and jury and put them in jail. We could just write information about them. And the people they really, you know, are in danger from the mafia are their business competitors and witnesses against them. Those are the ones they like to kill. So you know, it's too late now, really. And
were any of your sources ever in danger while you were talking to them?
I'm sure they were. Nothing so far has happened to any of them. It's like I said, I think they always thought that none of this information would really get out. And they were wrong.
We are talking with Pete Bruton, the author of The Mafia, the CIA, and George Bush, SBI Publishers, distributed by Hearst. And it should be on your bookshelves when you hear this. Pete Bruton, perhaps the most significant, expensive, comprehensive SNL Mafia CIA ripoff has to do with a particular Florida land deal, which seems to include a cast of thousands, or at least dozens. We're talking about, we have Walter Mischer back for another show. We have Robert Corson, the CIA mule, who was the who owned Vision Bank. We have the St. Joe Paper Company. We have DuPont people in here. We have Billie Jean Garman, who's Corson's mother or stepmother.
Mother.
And this goes on and on and on. So we want to talk about this, and we want to be very specific about who the people are. And this includes some of the key CIA people, and includes offshore banking, so on and so forth. It's a complicated affair, but it's a very important, very expensive one to taxpayers. So why don't you give us an overview on exactly what happened, and then we can get into who some of the players are.
Okay. In 1986, the St. Joe Paper Company, which is the largest landowner in Florida, and it is owned by the Alfred I. DuPont Testamentary Trust, which is a DuPont entity. And the St. Joe Paper Company, in the largest sale of raw land in Florida history, sold 21,000 acres for $200 million to a two-bit Houston home builder named Mike Atkinson. And to understand this deal, you have to go back to another deal, earlier deal in Houston. Atkinson had come to Houston in the late 70s, was a little home builder, and had met someone, a woman from Kuwait, who introduced him to some big Kuwaiti and Saudi businessmen, and flew Atkinson over to Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, and he gets involved with these people and is representing some of their interests in investing their money and settling the things in Houston. Now, this apparently got him involved with some, you know, really big shots like Walter Mischer. Walter Mischer shows up on his financial statement in 1983 as a reference. He also began to do weapons deals at this time into the Middle East, into Iran and Iraq and Kuwait. The first big land deal that Atkinson did was he bought Meyerland Shopping Center in Houston. It's an old, well-respected shopping center in the middle of a well-respected, venerable Jewish community in southwest Houston. This owned by the Meyer family. It's not a modern shopping center. It's not totally enclosed, but it's in a very good location on the southwest loop in Houston. The shopping center was worth probably about $25 million. The matriarch of the Meyer family is Leota Meyer Hess. She said the next generation, the second generation, her children and nieces and nephews and their children wanted to sell the shopping center and get their money. There was a $4 million mortgage on it. So, you know, you take that off and it's to them about $20, $21 million they would get. And Mrs. Hess did not want to sell. And she said, well, I'll only sell if we get $35 million for it. No one would pay $35 million for it. All the people that do shopping centers and invest in that kind of thing would only go like $25 million. And one day, Mrs. Hess is going downtown to see her attorneys, Fulbright and Jaworski, when she meets her old friend Walter Mischer. And Mischer starts asking her about the shopping center and tells her she ought to sell it. You know, she's got no business running that, she ought to sell it. Well, a couple of weeks later, Mike Atkinson appears in Mrs. Hess's office with his attorney saying they want to buy the shopping center and that Walter Mischer had sent them. And they were going to pay $35 million. And Miss Hess did not like Atkinson and Collins. She knew the center was not worth $35 million. They didn't ask to see her financial statements or the leases or anything. They didn't ask any questions. They just wanted to buy the shopping center. And so, but her relatives, the next generation, wanted their money. Now they'd get $10 million more. They'd get $30 million in cash for a shopping center that's worth $25. And so they sold. Now, the same day Atkinson when he buys the shopping center, he buys it in the name of a company in the Isle of Jersey, which is a tax haven island in the English Channel between England and France that people go to hide and you know, keep their money from taxes. And the company's name was Barbados, and it was supposed to be representing some of Atkinson's Arabian partners. Well, he buys it in the name of Barbados for $35 million, flips it the same day to his company for $70 million. And then the money that to finance all of this came from Lamar Savings.
What do you mean flips it?
Just sold it immediately. Sold it to me, no added value. He just doubled the price on paper. For you know, there's no economic reason, just to jack up the price. The money to finance the transaction came from Lamar Savings in Austin. Lamar Savings was the same SNL that had been involved with Adnan Khashoggi. They had taken special interest rate deals with Mario Renda and other questionable dealings. And what happened? They funded $47 million cash, but the mortgage for the $47 million was just half of the shopping center. And there were some other properties involved as well, some surrounding properties. So essentially what Atkinson had done is had taken a shopping center that was worth $25 million and in one day jacked up its apparent value to $100 million. Okay, and the money came from a savings and loan. Barbados, this Isle of Jersey company, made an instant pay profit, cash profit of $10 million for doing nothing. Absolutely nothing. $10 million goes to the Isle of Jersey, to these supposed Arabs. Eventually, some $30 million would go to the Isle of Jersey from the Meyerland deal. By the way, Walter Mischer's bank kicked in $5 million that went to the Isle of Jersey. Herman K. Beebe's Continental Savings, $20 million. San Jacinto Savings, which was involved in a deal with Herman Beebe, Allied Bank, and Continental in an earlier deal, kicked in $5 million. Another fraud-riddled SNL called Delta Savings kicked in a little over $5 million. All of this goes to the Isle of Jersey. All right, that's the preliminary to the Florida land deal, because the next year, Atkinson goes to Florida, meets with Jake Beeland, who headed the St. Joe Paper Company for the DuPonts, and they decide to sell him the 21,000 acres for $200 million. Everybody, every expert that's ever been questioned about that deal said it was totally ridiculous, that it wasn't worth that money and the development plans were, you know, were just not there. It was obviously either stupid or a scam. Now, they ended up, when they consummated the deal, a company called Panhandle Coast Investments ended up making a sales contract with St. Joe Paper Company, and then they were going to flip it to Atkinson. And the whole idea was to create a $20 million profit that that Atkinson would allegedly owe the Isle of Jersey so they could get the money off the Isle of Jersey. That's the way they did it. They would create fake promissory notes that Atkinson would sign. You know, I owe you, you know, Isle of Jersey Company, $20 million. And there would be no value. I mean, they had not paid him $20 million. It was all bogus. But since it was on the Isle of Jersey, you couldn't get to that to prove that it was bogus. And then you just send $20 million to the Isle of Jersey, and they cancel the IOU, and nobody's the wiser. They did that with Meyerland, and they did it with the St. Joe Paper Company deal. And so the person that set up Panhandle Coast Investments, allegedly to front this deal for the Arabs and Atkinson, was a Miami attorney named Lawrence Freeman. And Lawrence Freeman has a long, colorful history with CIA and mafia people. He was Lawrence Freeman was a money launderer for Santo Traficante, the mob boss of Florida, and he was the law partner of Paul Helliwell, one of the original founders of the CIA, one of the top operatives and agents for the CIA.
Who had a lot to do with the inventing of offshore banking, money laundering,
yes.
Moving, you know, working with negotiable instruments.
Yeah, I'm going to get to that. Helliwell started Castle Bank and Trust with a Chicago attorney named Burton Cantor who represented some mob interests. And Castle Bank and Trust was in the Cayman Islands and laundered money for the mob and the CIA. Freeman was hired by Helliwell's company and then became the in-house counsel to Castle Bank and Trust and then left to start his own practice where he was laundering money for mafia people and CIA people. He's brought in to front this deal. After his company signs a sales contract, then he assigns his interest to Atkinson, and then a month later he is indicted for laundering drug money for a man named Jack DeVoe, who turns out to have connections to the CIA. Okay, they do the deal. The money comes, $80 million comes from Hill Financial Savings in Red Hill, Pennsylvania, which has done deals with $200 million worth of deals with Richard Rossmiller, the Denver man connected to Herman K. Beebe, has done deals with Mainland Savings and a Detroit mafia associate that was dealing with Mainland. Has done other deals with Vernon Savings and Delta Savings. They're brought in to do the main financing. They need $20 million more. That comes from Robert Corson's Vision Bank Savings. And that basically ended up busting Vision Bank Savings. The bulk of the money, almost $70 million in cash, went to St. Joe Paper Company.
Could you just remind people with a few details who Robert Corson is?
Robert Corson is the CIA mule and Walter Mischer's former son-in-law. He was in business with Richard Brennick. He was associated with John Riddle and Mike Atkinson. So Atkinson then, of course, defaults on the loan. I mean, he was supposed to develop. Atkinson was supposed to have all these grandiose development plans for the 21,000 acres. He doesn't pay off the loan to Hill Financial. St. Joe Paper Company forecloses on the deed. They take back the best 1,800 shoreline acres, and they also got almost $70 million in cash. They really made out. They came out way ahead. They were the big beneficiaries of this land deal. Another probably $7 or $8 million went to the Isle of Jersey, the same company that got the money out of Meyerland and the same companies that Lawrence Freeman was using to launder Jack DeVoe's drug money and the same companies John Dick, the Denver businessman tied into the Silverado crowd, was using for his business interests. I mean, these same Isle of Jersey companies were doing all this at the same time. And we found out later that there were some invoices in the money, the $30 million or so that went to Isle of Jersey. It looked like $10 million of that was used to buy Volvo trucks for Kuwait. The thing is that the Kuwaiti company would not have needed to use Mike Atkinson to buy $10 million of Volvo trucks. I mean, they could just go to their bank or pay cash. We found out later that in the BCCI scandal that invoices for Lyft trucks were used as a secret code word for missiles, weapons. And in the investigation of the B&L scandal in the Atlanta Bank branch of this Italian bank that got the guarantees from the U.S. Government to make loans to Iraq that they then apparently used to buy weapons, that one of the code words for Scud missile launchers were Volvo trucks.
Now, these were these so-called Volvo trucks that were missiles or missile launchers were going to Kuwait?
Going to Iraq. Yes. And, you know, it's so far it's circumstantial evidence, but it's very strong. I mean, it's the kind of thing that a prosecutor would want to jump on immediately, and nobody has. I mean, Atkinson got convicted, sentenced to 11 years in jail. With a good time, he'll be out in 3. And he's got, you know, millions salted offshore. So he's not in. He doesn't have to talk. Corson will probably cop a plea, and he may go to trial. I don't know. He won't get, you know, he'll get slapped on the wrist, do a few years, and be out. There's no incentive for these people to talk and tell what happened.
When would these missiles have gone to Iraq?
It was in 86. Even maybe earlier than that, 85, 86. This is a time, you know, where Iran and Iraq are having this huge war, and the United States is basically supplying both sides. I mean, we wanted them basically to kill each other off or, you know, maintain the balance of terror, and we could supply both sides with weapons, and everybody makes out. Of course, we know that Scud missile launchers were later used on American troops during the Gulf War.
So this is another possible aspect of Iraqgate.
Yes.
In which transfers are happening through the BNL bank. And this is a situation, I mean, I can't help remembering we're talking about your book, The Mafia, the CIA, and George Bush. And people who have looked at Iraqgate know that George Bush played an extensive role personally and with his administration in facilitating these loans for Iraq. Essentially what it came down to is George Bush made these weapons available. He made it possible for Iraq to buy them with U.S.-backed tax dollars, and then he attempted to cover it up. So is there any connection here between the administration turning a blind eye? Or
I don't know. We don't know yet. I think that bears investigating.